We're going to get started for the panel on the gay liberation movement. My name is Heidi Claus. I am one of the National Union of Students National Queer Officers. The other one is sitting right next to me. Liam Byrne is also a National Office Bearer with the National Union of Students, the other queer officer. He studied the gay liberation movement here at Melbourne University. He's also part of the Equal Love Organising Committee, which is organising the upcoming National Day of Action for Equal Rights. Liz Ross has been active in the gay and lesbian movement since 1972. She's been a long-term union activist as well, has written an awful lot about the gay and lesbian movement. She also has an upcoming book about the gay liberation movement in Australia, so I think we'll all be looking forward to that with bated breath. She's also written a book that we have upstairs on the Builders Labourers Federation, and is involved in the gay and lesbian archives. I think she's passed some leaflets around for that. We were going to have Daniel Marshall today. Unfortunately, his mother had a brain aneurysm, and so he was unfortunately unable to attend. So we wish him well. All right, and obviously his mother. I'm going to ask Liam to begin, and Liam and Liz will both speak for about 20 minutes each, and then we'll have time for questions and discussion afterwards.
All right, thanks, Heidi. Well, I'm just going to pass something around which Liz actually supplied me. Paul, could you just grab that and chuck that around? It's a photo of a rather symbolic and important event in the history of gay liberation. It's from 1972, January, when with the words, "Gay liberation has come out, not only in Sydney, but also in Australia," gay liberation was formally launched. And these are the words of Dennis Altman, who's the author of the pathbreaking work Homosexual Oppression and Liberation, which came out, I think it was 71, and he was speaking at a Sydney University forum on sexual liberties. And there had been radical activism before this, and gay liberation had actually split from another group a couple of months before, but this is really symbolically where gay liberation started. And some of the activism had been spearheaded by sections of the Campaign Against Moral Persecution, or CAMP, which was a bit of a pun, because CAMP was one of the ways that gay and lesbians were one of the terms we were referred by. And I wanted to contrast these words of Altman, of gay liberation coming out, with the words that was actually published in a 1970 editorial of this, which I'm passing around, the CAMP newspaper. And they said, "We do not advocate that homosexuals should immediately march down the streets carrying gay liberation placards, but we do feel it necessary. We do feel it should be recognised this is a necessary step to be taken eventually. Maybe not for 20 years. And I mean, the contrast between these two statements says an awful lot. You know, a lot about where the movement was and how just how quickly campaigns and movements can shift and change. Because the CAMP editors, I would argue, were actually not writing out of some innate conservatism or what have you, but rather from a lack of confidence that the methods of struggle that had been employed so effectively in the rest of the world could actually work in Australia. You know, an example of this Australian exceptionalism, that the rest of the world is where fantastic radical things happen and nothing ever goes on here. I'm sure comrades and friends here are familiar with these sort of arguments. So today I'm going to be focusing particularly on the experience of the Melbourne Gay Liberation Front. In Melbourne, the GLF, Gay Liberation Front, was primarily based on the campuses. In fact, it was primarily based on this campus. And as it so happens, many of its organising and its meetings actually happened in this building, the Student Union, which is an extra argument to clean up your rubbish and treat it with respect. The GLF was an organisation whose politics and very existence reflected the broader context of radicalisation within Australian society in the early 1970s. They represented a qualitative shift in terms of those who were advocating for gay rights in Australia, because previously this mantle had been worn by what was predominantly middle-class, small liberal, straight-identifying reformers who felt, you know, embarrassed about the backwardness of Australian society and so advocated for homosexual law reform. Now, leaving aside these projects, which were conducted on behalf of gays and lesbians, the GLF actually aimed at the complete overthrow of a system that was oppressive for gays and lesbians through to its very core. And I would argue, actually, in this process, they carved out a space for gays and lesbians to analyse our own oppression with our own voices and to actually challenge the inbuilt systemic homophobia. Gay liberation was inspired particularly by the social and political context of the early 1970s in general and the international women's liberation and black civil rights movement in particular. And the concept of liberation, of physical and intellectual freedom and pride in oneself, was actually adapted by gay liberation directly from these movements. And unlike the previous campaigns that had gone on beforehand, which primarily focused upon some areas of anti-discrimination law reform, gay liberation were self-identified revolutionaries who were concerned with total societal change. And in fact, some activists, though it should be said not all of them, saw most law reform really as being utterly irrelevant, commenting, such change in Australia would make no difference to camps at all. And it was this new understanding, you know, of entrenched societal oppression, you know, rather than it simply being ignorance or discrimination being the major barrier to equality, I think positioned gay liberation firmly within the left at a time when this was a, you know, the dominant force for change in society. And there certainly were left-wing, even Marxist currents within the movement. And I did just want to stray very quickly to mention that in terms of the interactions, I was looking through the Gay Liberation Front newsletter and I found a very interesting little tidbit. This isn't the most political, but I just thought it was funny, where they actually, Gay Liberation and a number of the socialist groups organised a football match against each other where the men would come along wearing dresses and all these sorts of things. And they then had an advertisement for a social afterwards where the Gay Liberation Front encouraged gays and lesbians to come along and not to be afraid of the trots, which I said I mostly just found funny. All right, so the Gay Liberation Front argued that, in fact, it is society that is the source of oppression, not the law, and not even the law in its function of and register of acceptable social norms. And alongside this argument came a belief that as gay oppression was the result of societal power structures, gay liberation was both part of and dependent upon larger social change. In fact, they were calling for a social revolution where it would not be gays and lesbians themselves, but rather the oppressive, straight society that would be transformed. And they said, it is up to camps to demand those changes. And this revolutionary perspective, the need to overthrow the system of capitalism, marks a steep radicalisation of the gay movement. And while much of the early work that was actually produced and written by the GLF tends to be very eclectic and highly personal, this is one of the key unifying factors that runs throughout them. You know, the sense of agency and ability for gays and lesbians to change society. And for the GLF, the goal that they were aiming for was true liberation, a society that would be free from structural homophobia, but would also constitute a return to a state of radical and polymorphous sexuality. And the most far-reaching definition of the term gay that they used was a natural state where the entire sex-gender system would be transcended. And a GLF-authorised gay manifesto declared, gay in its most far-reaching sense means not homosexual, but sexually free. And it was contested by the GLF that freedom from sexual repression and norms of capitalist society would, of course, not just lead to the liberation of gays, but in their words, will ultimately lead to the liberation of all people. By refusing to live in the enforced, ghettoised environment, the liberated person will affect all people he comes into contact with. And I apologise for the gendered language, but this is their words. They've dreamed of a society that would see the liberation of other social groups as well, so such as women, and the creation of what they termed a genderless society. That is, a society that doesn't differentiate on the basis of sex, where people relate to each other irrespective of gender. And while I think the theoretical basis of a lot of these imaginings, when you go through them in their fullest form, are perhaps a wee bit questionable, I do think that this project of liberation proved an advance for gays and lesbians and by far outstripped the hopes and ambitions of gay campaigners just a few short years before. And the GLF, above all, was an activist body. It wasn't just about talking. Its members were people who actually wanted to make an impact on society and its attitudes. One of the most important aspects of this activism, I think, was the fact that it was openly gay and lesbian people speaking on their own behalf. And I don't think really the importance of this can be emphasised enough. Society at this point was literally at the stage where you could go through life believing you had never seen or met a lesbian or gay person. Being gay was termed as being a sin or immoral, or in some of its most hideous senses, as being a medical condition, which phony psychiatrists could and regularly did treat through aversion therapy and in some cases through lobotomising gay and lesbian people. So I think actually having our own voices, which were being raised to meet and turn back this chorus of reaction, was a decisive factor in engaging people in the movement, including people who were not gay or lesbian themselves. And I personally believe as well that this visible, loud, vibrant activism from gay and lesbian people themselves has capacity to save lives, because it can really be a lifeline for people who are otherwise drowning in a sea of hatred, shame, persecution, ridicule, and loneliness. So gay liberation, I think, saves lives. And in this vein, I just want to mention that a rather historic moment actually occurred in this very building. It was on the 17th of March, 1970, which was just before the GLF had been formed, but when the forerunners of it, which was the Melbourne branch of CAMP, many of which are split into GLF, participated in a debate that was held in the Student Union Student Union Buffet Hall. And for comrades who've seen the bookstall, on your way up the stairs, just before the level where the bookstall is, on your right, there's this big closed sort of double doors, and the Union Buffet Hall is just through there. And this was significant because in this debate, this was the first time in Melbourne that openly gay people had spoken on behalf of gays and lesbians. And actually, it was one of the first times in Australia as well. And one of the speakers at this debate was one of these horrible so-called psychiatrists who spoke of the use of aversion therapy or electroshock therapy and its ability to cure homosexuality. And a CAMP member who was debating Alan Beggs then audaciously, you know, obviously attacked this guy, but then audaciously asked all the straight people in the audience, how many of them would be willing to go through such therapy to cure them of their sexuality? And this sort of quite confrontational approach in one way led to a, you know, a real fusillade of angry interventions and angry questions, not of Beggs and of CAMP, but of the psychiatrist. And not only were gays and lesbians speaking for themselves, but they were also quite scathing of the smoil liberals, who they said, cherish the secret belief that you are a little bit better because you sleep with the opposite sex, but who are really still asleep in your cradle, and we will be the nightmare that awakens you. So gay liberation was, unlike these earlier liberal attitudes, an attempt to go beyond the liberal ability to tolerate homosexuality while still regarding it as a rather sad misplacement of energy, which actually a number of the campaigners for gay reforms, the straight middle-class campaigners, did. And actually, it was aimed at asserting the value of homosexuality as a self-expression of a large number of people. Organisationally, the notion of liberation that was held by the GLF, particularly influenced by the prevailing counter-culture at the time, which held sway with many of its members, led to a rejection of any sort of formal organisation or authority, which created a rather chaotic and unstructured form of activism, leading to some achievements that probably in retrospect were more personal than political, but were still vitally important. So the more outward activities they had focused on, you know, debates, forums, demonstrations, or the smaller scale demonstrations, which they called ZAPs. These activities were aimed at confronting society and could range from anything. It was like a small scale confrontational thing, such as a man appearing in makeup in a public place to street theatre, disruption of lectures by aversion therapists. In Adelaide, they stormed a television station. And as anybody who was on the Radical Walking Tour that was hosted here last night may have heard, it also included such things as postering the entire Melbourne Uni campus to announce the outrageous exhibition of two men on the lawn kissing. Which sounds funny, but I don't mean to demean it in any way, because apparently in the context of this, this grabbed, you know, hundreds of students to come along. But it's also important to see, in the social context, these were audacious acts. These were took a lot of bravery and took a lot of guts to actually do them. One famous example of one of these zaps, and probably my personal favourite, was on the 1st of December 1972, where there was a gay liberation demo in Melbourne, and a breakaway group of protesters barged into the Myers store on Bourke Street, which apparently a lot of radical groups tend to barge into at various points.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about the politest way to say what they did when they were in the store. I think it would be to say that they tested the beds. and the makeup. But, you know, these demonstrations... Oh, and Liz has got something great to hand around.
This is
part of that zap, great. These demonstrations were essentially quite celebratory. You know, they were splashy, visible expressions of gay pride. And Gay Liberation at Melbourne issued a statement upon its formation in 72 explaining some of its activities. And it's not the activism that, you know, for capital A, comrades may be accustomed to today, but as I said, in the context, they were audacious acts. And they said, we intend to be ourselves. You will see gay couples walking around openly, arm in arm, dancing at union nights, etc., so that students on campus will be accustomed to having gay people amongst them as a legitimate and integral part of the community, so that we will be accepted rather than tolerated. And this was at a time when actually it was seen as an incredibly daring act that is one of the things that you have to do then and now as an affiliated club to the student union is you have to go to the Commonwealth Bank, I'm not sure if it's still the Commonwealth then, and open a bank account. And it was actually a big debate over who would do this, because effectively by doing that you would out yourself. And that was seen as something that took a lot of bravery to do, which it actually was. The regular weekly meetings that GLF held were central to the life of the group, and the early meetings were held in the undergraduate and graduate lounges on the second floor of this building. If that sounds vaguely familiar to people, it's because it's actually where we've been meeting for a large part of this conference. And these meetings were often very large, with maybe 50 to 60 people regularly coming, and reflected the euphoria which so many felt during these early and radical days. It's been described, all these gay people in one place, talking, working, meeting, cruising, debating, sharing, planning actions, or simply basking in the company of so many gay people. And given the university base, the meetings mostly attracted, you know, younger and political people, but the group really had its own diversity. There were, you know, socialists and Marxists who wanted to link up the world, link up the struggle with, you know, the struggles going on, such as with the Black Civil Rights Movement and women's liberation. Apparently radical Christians who didn't really have an idea about what their sexuality was, but still managed to come along anyway. You know, people who were out to all of the world, you know, wanted to be on television expressing their sexuality, and you had people who were actually afraid to be seen at the meetings. Now, much of the activity of the GLF focused upon the revolutionising of the self and a development of a liberated self-consciousness through consciousness-raising groups, which had their roots in the women's liberation and black power movements, basically small groups of people where you come together to discuss oppression, debate it out, talk about how it impacted your personal life, all these sort of things. Participants related, consciousness raising has radicalised my ideas and made me see the political nature of every aspect of my life. And such a process was the tactical expression of the political belief that the first stage of the revolution would be the revolution of the self, the liberation of the self from internalised homophobia and sexism. And many participants in the gay liberation saw your sexuality as being a real political statement, as much as it was a personal issue. And one explained, lesbianism is a personal choice. It is also a political statement. We are forced to fuse the personal and political. Oppression is a political fact. And this focus on individual and internal revolution, a revolution of ideas and consciousness, was framed as being a more realistic form of revolt in an age, in their words, no longer is there any winter palaces or bastilles that can be stormed to overthrow the system. So in this new age, consciousness raising was to be the first step in the revolution, and it was to be the mechanism that drives the movement forward, but it was also seen as being a unifying space. One participant related, it was a framework which allows the revolutionary and the Mount Waverley housewife to operate at their different levels. And leaving aside the implicit elitism of such statements, I think you know, it reflects that this form of activism crucially remained purely at the realm of ideas and attitudes. So oppression was not what it is for Marxists, you know, the material reality of structural power imbalances, but it was a question of attitudes and terminology. And so the use of certain terms came to be deemed as an assertion of power. So even using the term homosexual was deemed as oppressive by many GLF members because it is imposed by society's norms, leading to a creation that they used a new term, the human sexual. Sort of, you know, reflects the fact that they didn't think there was anything unnatural or anything about like that about being gay or lesbian, and that it actually wasn't a medical condition, such as the term homosexual implies. Now, added to the sort of countercultural insistence that the personal is the political, came the representation of a self, you know, the personal activities that are intended as being political acts. So the wearing of badges around our campus and in the streets, kissing and holding hands with people of the same sex, men wearing dresses, all of these were seen as attempts to, I suppose, consciousness raise amongst the broader community. But consciousness raising also held a different function as well, which was a way to combat the internalised homophobia that capitalism creates. And the need for this in this context was evidenced by those within the GLF itself who, unfortunately, just to say, through suicide or self-harm, were murdered by the homophobic system. And GLF member Tony Cruz speaks quite eloquently of this, and I think it is worth just, even though this is meant to be a bit more boisterous and to go over the inspiration of the activism, to talk about what they were going through at the same time. And Tony Cruz says, there were some tragedies. I can remember a guy who was involved right at the beginning called Rex Roma who committed suicide. I can still remember that because I thought, here we are. We found Nirvana, the truth. And yet here's someone who's involved and yet he's killed himself. And I found that really disturbing, that there's a worm in the bud somewhere and that just shouldn't be. So consciousness raising was about combating these ideas within the self to allow you to then take part in your activism more broadly. So I suppose in sum, gay liberation was about challenging the entire foundations of the system. And while, you know, it must be recognised by all but the perhaps the most fanciful slash delusional amongst us that the GLF actually didn't succeed in overthrowing capitalism and with it all forms of oppression, I think the whole experience of the GLF and gay liberation more broadly was vital. because I think they staked a claim on behalf of all gays and lesbians to the rights that are ours, and the right in particular to be treated as equals. An experience of gay liberation and a contribution of Melbourne's Gay Liberation Front was vital to giving people beyond their immediate ranks the confidence to celebrate their sexuality and also to lay the basis for campaigns and movements to come. And the effects are really quite tangible when you look at the social attitude polls on a question of law reform, which the GLF themselves did often see as a subordinate question. So in 1967, there was a poll about who supported the decriminalisation of gay acts, and only 22% of respondents supported decriminalisation. In 1974, this same poll was taken again, and this time 54% of people supported decriminalisation. You know, a shift in attitudes that I think reflects the broader political radicalisation, but also the effect of gays and lesbians themselves refusing to be silenced. And I suppose I'm just going to very quickly finish now saying how proud and grateful I am to be given an opportunity to tell this small part of a small story, a small part of a much larger story, because I think that it's very important that we continue to keep alive the memories of these organisations and this movement, whose experience were fundamental to the state of gay and lesbian self-activity and also to understanding our position in society today. And I think these are important because these politics and these stories are absolutely vital to understanding our past, but I think they're equally vital in our future. Thanks.
Right, now I'll call on Liz to Liz Ross, long-term activist in the women's and gay and lesbian movement.
Smashed by the twin forces of fascism and Stalinism in the lead-up to the Second World War, the homosexual rights movement was revived in the ashes of that same war, becoming, by the late 1960s, the gay liberation movement. Wars and economic crises, as we know only too well, wreak death and destruction. But this isn't the whole, you know, picture, because for our side, there can be so much promise. With these upheavals, the fundamental flaws of capitalism are displayed for all to see, and from these cracks in the system, from the huge social dislocation they cause, we see the possibilities of social transformation. Everything from the fully-fledged workers' revolution in the middle of war, as happened in Russia in 1917, and then the accompanying decriminalisation of homosexuality, through to the smallest flowerings of organisation, the gatherings of half a dozen people or so at war's end to begin the fight for reform. In the US, we saw the first post-war homosexual groups, Mattachine in 1950 and Daughters of Bilitis in 1955. So it's particularly appropriate to have this panel on gay liberation when we're here together from all and, you know, every area of struggle to be part of the challenge to capitalism and war. And, of course, to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the birth of gay liberation itself. But to return to World War II, many on the left believed the aftermath of the Second World War would resemble World War I, revolution and economic crisis. But instead, and for reasons I haven't got time to go into here, we had post-war occupation, the threat of annihilation by atomic weapons, and a wave of repression. A Cold War, including massive sort of peacetime propaganda war, which targeted the left, homosexuals, unions, and other so-called deviants, and saw thousands sacked from their jobs, many jailed, while also heavily reinforcing the heterosexual nuclear family norm, or what they called the norm. And I'll just give you one little example. The Oxford Dictionary of 1951, for example, listed Sunday shopping and entertainment, along with prostitution, drugs and homosexuality, as threats to the social fabric. They were actually listed under what vice meant. But the 1950s were also a very contradictory period. On the one hand, the repression, the continuation of war by other means, the atom bomb, harsher anti-union laws, and early on, economic instability. But on the other hand, a desire for a better world, rising living standards from a post-war economic boom as the system stabilised, mass media, mass education, mass tourism, and particularly with the media, you get the television bringing the world into your own lounge. And as in every generation, the music of protest or rebellion. And in this case, rock and roll, with its explicit sexuality, in words, in rhythm, in dance, and in the subculture. And I think that's as often that's something that's overlooked. It was, it really sort of swept through the youth of the time. The American Students for a Democratic Society put it this way in their founding manifesto. Not quite. We are people of this generation, bred in at least modest comfort, housed now in the universities, but looking uncomfortably in the world we inherit. And that world, they said, was characterised by, and I'll quote again, the permeating and victimising fact of human degradation, symbolised by the Southern struggle against racial bigotry, the enclosing fact of the Cold War, symbolised by the presence of the bomb. And but crucially, they added, they had a yearning to believe that there is an alternative in the present, that something can be done to change circumstances in the school, the workplace, the bureaucracies, the government. But what was the alternative and how to win it? Was reforming the system enough, or would it take a revolution? And, you know, where did Australia stand on all of this? Events in two countries played a pivotal role in determining the political makeup of Australia's gay movement. Britain, with the emphasis on reform, and the US with its more revolutionary trajectory. And I'll take reform first. Australia, with a legal system largely based on that of its English colonisers, not surprisingly, closely followed British law. And here, as in the UK, while lesbianism was largely invisible to the law, male homosexuality was illegal, with draconian jail sentences of sometimes up to 21 years. So moves for legal reform or repeal, as many called for, were a constant. And I really do want to emphasise, I have a slight... I know this is what we thought when gay liberation first started, that law reform didn't matter, but I actually had to sort of reassess my own opinion about that because it was actually important, and it was an important thread in the movement. And, you know, after all, for men, it was a pretty grim world when you could be charged, even jailed, and lose your job at any time the law chose. And that's not to say that women were exempt from the discrimination, the psychiatric treatment, and all the other horrors, but, you know, we have to look at the institutionalised law there as well. Now, Britain began the push to change. The move for law reform got a huge boost in 1953 from a case that rivalled the earlier Oscar Wilde trial for scandal and publicity. When a well-known journalist, several lords and some young airmen were caught in what was then illegal sex, the charges and subsequent jailing precipitated a major investigation, and I'll tell you right now, the lords didn't get put in jail. So this precipitated this major investigation into the laws on homosexuality and prostitution. By 1957, the Wolfenden Committee, as it was called, recommended decriminalisation at least between consenting adults in private. Now, these moves prompted the first attempts that we know of here in Australia to form a society to fight for reform. A young gay man and Communist Party member, Laurie Collinson, was the instigator. But despite, you know, generally favourable coverage of Wolfenden in the Australian press, he found no support. I'll just pass around a picture and a bit of an article about Laurie Collinson that was in the NCB more recently. But this is the report in the People magazine, and it's got shock sex report. But inside, I mean, despite all of that, it's actually a very serious thing. And inside, which was amazing when I first saw it, it said, mankind can never repay its great debt to some practising homosexuals. And it's got a picture of they're all men, but it's got a picture of a number of men who were, you know, important in terms of Western society. And here on Melbourne University campus, from 1962, homosexual law reform was openly discussed. And in actual fact, some of it led by the Church of England, who was also involved in the Wolfenden Committee issues. In 1964, the debating union held a meeting on the issue, attracting some 500 students to hear speakers present the case for and against decriminalisation of homosexuality. And in the end, they took a vote at the end, and the vote was 281 for and 98 against. So pretty amazing. When England finally reformed in 1967, it was again reported favourably here. The Sydney Morning Herald editorial declared that homosexuality was neither a crime nor a disease, but rather a condition that has brought, because of the sanctions against it, unnecessary suffering to about one man in every 20 and has brought to society at large a multitude of evils, deceit, blackmail, suicide and disease. And not that the Sydney Morning Herald was all that good on a whole range of issues, listing people's names and addresses after the 1978 Mardi Gras, refusing to publish a review of Dennis Altman's book and things like that. But, I mean, they did at least say that. And the need for change couldn't have been clearer than in a case in Melbourne. And this is 9 years later. This is in 1975. A magistrate ordered that two men be transported to South Australia, where, unlike Victoria, homosexuality had been partially legalised. And that was because they insisted on wanting to continue to live together after they'd been found guilty of having sex in their own home. The fight for homosexual law reform in Australia actually began as part of a broader campaign against the three so-called victimless crimes. There is abortion, prostitution and homosexuality. Its first meeting was in Canberra in July 1969. Women's Liberation soon took over the fight for abortion, while gays in their own group, CAMP that Liam referred to before, and later the Homosexual Law Reform Coalition, took up the fight in 1971, going right through to 1997, when Tasmania, the last state, reformed its laws after a spirited campaign, and including a successful boycott of Tasmanian produce, including all the expensive cheeses that went to all the restaurants in Sydney, and they were boycotting there, so it was part of persuading the Tasmanian government. While fighting for law reform and even repeal has been important, it's never transformed, at least here in Australia, into a fundamental questioning of the system. For that to happen, gays had to look to the US, where liberation rather than reform hit the headlines. And in America, as Liam referred to, it was the mass civil rights movement, but also the anti-Vietnam War campaign and women's liberation, demanding full rights and equality for African Americans, that the US abandon its imperialist wars, and liberation for women that provided the inspiration for gay liberation. Even the first post-war gay rights group, the Mattachine Society, formed in 1950 by Harry Hay, began on a more militant basis. Hay and others who'd been in the Communist Party brought to the movement some of the best ideas and practices from the Communist Party. The social change came through mass action, and hence the need to build a large gay community or constituency that was capable of militancy. These early activists saw homosexuals as a class, asserting that unless gays began to view themselves as proud members of a class, rather than as sinners, criminals or deviants, they would not want to be part of a gay rights movement. And however, remembering that this was in the middle of a homophobic Cold War, the early movement was, by today's standards, fairly conservative. The first On the Streets protest took till 1964 to appear, and while it was to hold, were quite bold in its demands for equal employment rights, its numbers on the streets were small, sort of half a dozen people, maybe up to 40 on occasions. But one demonstration in 1965 did start to show this radical potential of the movement. At a Dewey restaurant chain in Philadelphia, which is a rare sort of all-night venue, young, black and white homosexuals and what they called persons wearing non-conformist clothing were regularly refused service. So one night they just had enough. So three of them started to protest, and then another 150 responded, and they had sit-ins and mass leafletings until they won. And they could go in any time they wanted. But the spark for mass struggle came 4 years later, and this is the anniversary of celebrating this year, after the night of June 28, 1969, at New York's Stonewall Bar. Police harassment was commonplace at gay bars and patrons often arrested. But that night and the next few, gays fought back. Young and old, lesbians and gay men, white, black and Chicano, transvestites and drag queens joined together in a pitched battle against the cops. And out of this riot came the gay liberation movement, a movement that demanded revolutionary change, liberation which would transform the whole world in the process. And this was, after all, and I haven't set the context for it in this talk, but we need to remember, this came just after France's May 68, which had really set the world on fire, and there was no doubt that around the world there really was revolution in the air. Groups that formed called themselves the Gay Liberation Front, deliberately and openly naming themselves after the National Liberation Front of Vietnam, the people challenging the might of the US Empire. They marched under the banner of gay pride, again taking up the slogans and actions of black power. In New York, the Gay Liberation Front publicly supported the Black Panthers and what they called revolutionary violence. And it was this American example that sparked the Australian Rights Organisation, a movement that was also fed by a combination of local demographic and political changes similar to those overseas. There was women's liberation, the anti-Vietnam War movement, Aboriginal activism, the Freedom Rides and the Gurindji sit-in, as well as an upsurge in worker militancy, all coinciding with the baby boomer generation, which is me. The highest ever proportion of under 25-year-olds, so it's about a quarter of the population, many becoming young militants in the workplace and the campus activists. And as in the US, it was an explosive mix. The first openly gay group, though, was this Australasian lesbian movement, again appearing a little bit conservative, but in fact very bold for the period in Australia. And it was here in Melbourne that this group was founded. It was determined to take its message out to the public unashamedly as lesbians through newspaper interviews and openly on television. And while the majority didn't see marching on the streets as the way forward, they did actually debate it. And ALM kept going for 2 years, and as the, two of its members commented later in an interview with me last year, we were the forerunners for others to follow on, the catalysts for change. And I've just got a couple of photocopies of newspaper reports about the group at the time that they formed. And some of it was a bit more hidden than others, but it just shows what they were prepared to do. By July 1970, the Campaign Against Moral Persecution, or CAMP, was launched in Sydney, announcing it's time for us to come out of the shadows and loudly demand our rights as human beings. But demonstrations, as Liam had said, weren't on the agenda here. But there's no doubt that songs like Bob Dylan's The Times They Are Changing more accurately described the world around them, and it wasn't long before CAMP was indeed marching on the streets. They were soon overtaken by the new gay liberation movement based on the militancy that, as Liam said, and which also did see its allies in the student and worker unions as well as other liberation groups. And they've got, I'll hand around a couple of manifestos. There's the Gay Liberation Manifesto that Liam mentioned, and also a little bit later, Manifesto of Socialist Homosexuals. Now, manifestos were the thing that everybody put out at that time. Everybody had their manifesto. So the manifesto questioned the more limited aims of a group like CAMP, and it says, shouldn't we demand reforms that will give us tolerance and equality? And they said, certainly we should. In a liberal democratic society, legal equality and protection from attack are the very least we should ask for. They are our civil rights, and this, I think, is exactly where the argument about gay marriage comes in. But, and this is going back to the 70s, but gay liberation does not just mean reforms, the manifesto went on. It means a revolutionary change in our whole society. It will take more than reforms to change this attitude because it is rooted in society's most basic institutions, the patriarchal family, and we'd actually add capitalism, and they do talk about capitalism as well. But we do not intend to ask for anything, they sort of wound up and said. We intend to stand firm and assert our basic rights. Now, the very first demonstration happened here on October 1971. And it's got one of my most favourite pictures, and that's a policeman very carefully perusing a copy of CAMP Inc. But also some sort of wonderful pictures of, the demonstration and the balloons and everything like that. So I'll pass that one around as well. Now, it actually wasn't over a particularly militant aim. It was focusing on a pre-selection battle in the Liberal Party, where a right-wing homophobe was standing against the then Attorney General and supporter of law reform. Now, the first gay lib banner was carried on International Women's Day in 1972, and I'll pass that around as well, and about 40 people marched with the banner. Later that year, and this gives you an idea of how quickly things were changing, later that year there were two gay rights demos and the first arrest for political activity rather than the crime of being a homosexual. As well, the first ever gay march in Australia, marking the fifth anniversary of law reform in Britain, which in most states, well, in almost all of Australia by that, at that point, had not happened. But again, in 1972, there was a high-profile murder of a university lecturer, George Duncan, by the South Australian cops. Of course, they never got blamed for it, and there was a big whitewash and everything like that. But that actually did trigger some partial law reform in South Australia. And everybody thought that this was going to sweep around Australia. Now, it didn't actually happen that way. But in that year, a well-known socialist activist, David Widdop, stood in the 1972 election, the election that brought Whitlam to power, against the then Prime Minister, Billy McMahon, and with a slogan saying, "I've got my eyes on Billy's seat." So I'll pass that one around as well. The year finished with a bang, which is the demonstration that Liam referred to, the ZAP that went into Myers and made hay in Myers on December the 1st, but also did march through the streets and were carrying things like homosexual apples and stuff like that. Well, what they called homosexual apples. Now, then the most ambitious of the movement's actions, nationwide, a whole week in September 1973, a week called Gay Pride Week, and there's a couple of pictures and reports of that going around as well. It saw first mass arrest of gays in, were 18 protesters in Martin Place in Sydney. Now, this was also one of the first occasions where we started to see the involvement of unions. There were some building workers who were there, and they doused the police with water. And it didn't stop the arrest, but they put up a whole lot of the bail money. Now, while the Stalinist left had been slow to support gay liberation, younger and leading members of the CPA, the Communist Party of Australia, were active from the beginning, as were the newer and smaller Trotskyist groups. Pride Week, for example, was supported by a group of people called Revolutionary Communists, some of the founders of our organisation, Socialist Alternative, and in 1974 they put out their Orientation Week bulletin. Also from 1973, there's a whole range of unions, peak union bodies, pressured by their members and because of the changes around them, to take up the gay cause. And we actually saw the first pink band when Builders Labourers Federation again backed up two students at Macquarie University. And other workers, people like teacher Michael Closey was chucked out of his school as he appeared on television, and a whole range of groups, black, women's, trade unions, supported him, and I'll pass around the report of that as well. And 6 years later on this campus, Terry Stokes was backed by the cafeteria workers after he was arrested after kissing a man outside a hotel in the city. One of the blue-collar unions, the plumbers, adopted its policies on the basis that homosexual discrimination is an industrial issue and has to be fought on that basis. There was a whole range of other unions. I've got sort of clippings here. New South Wales Railways, Telstra, Teachers Union, the Trades and Labour, New South Wales Trades and Labour Council, the peak union bodies. The student union body, the Australian Union of Students, which the NUS is the also was very active, had organised the first conference where there were 650 gays turn up here at Melbourne University. I'm not sure it was Melbourne University, in Melbourne anyway, and also had, you know, encouraged research into attitudes and ways to change attitudes for gays on campuses. Then, of course, we had, you know, jumping from 73, jumping through to 78 with the beginning of Sydney's now flamboyantly famous Mardi Gras. But an event that actually started with mass arrests, more demos, more arrests, national campaign, marching on May Day under two banners, the gay 10% is everywhere, unions must support their homosexual members, and homosexual rights now through workers' solidarity. I'll pass around a number of those kind of union and pro-union sort of demonstrations and things. Now, these early days were exciting. The daring, the enthusiasm, the imagination. A movement that, as activist Craig Johnson commented, attracted the imagination of homosexual youth, defining for most people what homosexual radicalism meant. But we would do a disservice to all these early battles if all we do is recount the tales of struggle. We still face a formidable enemy, the capitalist system. Even as it has created environmental and economic catastrophe, the ruling class is still trying to convince us that it is a system worth saving. And as we have seen time and time again, they are prepared to trash our rights if it ensures the survival of their system. We need only look back at the 1930s, which has some parallels with today, when the German ruling class had in its sights not just the strongest workers' movement in the world, but the movements for homosexual and women's rights as well. And they succeeded in their all-out attack on these progressive forces, and fascism was the result. Throughout the whole history of the homosexual movement, gay movement, GLBTIQ rights movement, there have been a battle of ideas about how to win liberation. Socialists have been involved in every step of the way, making sure that Marxist theories of oppression and revolution have been hotly debated alongside anarchist, separatist and openly reformist explanation strategies and tactics. There's no doubt that the second wave of the homosexual rights movement, gay liberation, has won significant gains within the system, gains many thought they would never see in their lifetime. But as Peggy Lee's number one hit in 1969 put it, and without for one moment denying the importance of what we've gained, Peggy sang, "Is that all there is?" In the early stages of women's and gay liberation, we fought for reforms to shake up the system, not to seek accommodation with it. We wanted liberation. We wanted a totally different society. And to win that society, as I hope the rest of this conference will also persuade you, our only hope is the fight for socialism. And as one of the badgers in the late 70s said, Mardi Gras was a riot, we need a revolution.